Welcome to the FinTech Scaling Show. This podcast is sponsored by the Growth Platform Framework. B2B FinTech startups accelerate customer acquisition and set up business operations to scale systematically. When you're ready to grow, reach out to us at richard@ipractitioners.com. Now, over to the show with Richard Dosey, founder and host. Hey, what's up, everyone? Today on the show, we have Simon Ellis, CEO and co-founder of SmartWage. Simon also holds positions as founding member and co-founder at other companies. Prior to this, Simon has worked as an investment analyst and has also done a stint at a Big Four. So really excited to welcome Simon onto the show. Hey, Simon, how's it going? Out in Kenya today. Wow.
Thanks, Rich. A little bit warmer than the UK, but it's great to be out in Kenya. And thanks for having me.
Awesome. Let's kick off the show and maybe we can go back in time. I don't know where in time we're going to go back to right now, because this is a bit of a maybe a personal question to kick off the show and to get our listeners to maybe understand the path you've taken. And the question I'd like to ask is, why did you decide to go out on your own and create businesses and be an entrepreneur? What was the motivation behind that?
I think I've always wanted to start a business, but it only really dawned on me. I worked at Deloitte for a number of years and I absolutely loved my time there, but I looked up at my partners and realized at some stage that I didn't want to be like them. And that was the kind of the turning point for me. I was actually working out in Japan and I suddenly realized that I needed to follow what was my passion. And I'd always been really interested in startups and entrepreneurship and had tried a number of things, which ultimately had failed. But I knew that if I wanted to dive into it, you know, the best way to learn how to swim is to get wet. I knew I had to quit my job and jump in. And so I did. And it was the best decision I ever made. It's been really hard since, but it's been fantastic. And I absolutely love what I do.
You mentioned Deloitte there, and obviously, you know, pretty respected company in the market and very well known. What were the decision points other than, you know, looking at your peers and looking at the partners that, I guess, forced the move out of that pretty impressive sort of space and company?
I think it's less to do with Deloitte. I think it's a fantastic company and the people I worked for were fantastic, but it was really what got my blood boiling. When I arrived in London, which was in early 2015, I kind of got somehow stumbled upon all the startup community and I started going to events by Crowdcube and Cedars. And that was when I got really excited and I would get home after an event and I would be, you know, my heart rate would be high and I'd be so excited about what I'd learned or what I'd seen and the sort of problems other people were solving. And so it was more about, for me, trying to align kind of my interest, my passion with what I wanted to actually do. And as I said, while I really enjoyed time at Deloitte, I knew there was something missing. And as soon as I always tell the story, I kind of left Deloitte and then went to work with a little startup in Cape Town called Digs Connect. And first day in the office was shorts and slop. And, you know, the excitement and the energy of solving a problem was pretty tangible. And that's kind of then I knew, I think I'm doing the right thing. And so far, it seems to have been the right decision.
And that sort of early part of your career working at Deloitte and other places, what did you take out of that time there? What learnings have you taken out that's helped you on your sort of entrepreneurial journey?
I mean, I studied to be an accountant. So probably the two things, Deloitte, I was in auditing for 3 years. And the biggest thing you learn about auditing is process. And I guess applying that to a startup, it's about creating processes which are scalable. And then obviously, you know, you learn how to work with and understand numbers and financial statements. And there's no doubt that that has helped me along the way substantially. But I also think in a roundabout way, having Deloitte in your CV has added credibility to who I am and what I do. And I think I learned a lot of soft skills. You have to manage teams from a very early, you know, from the second year, you're managing teams. I was involved in the recruitment, so I had to recruit a lot of people. So I think a lot of the hard skills were fantastic, but I think actually the biggest benefit came from the soft skills, which take time to learn.
You talk about soft skills there. What do you actually mean by soft skills? What particular takeaways has really helped you as you push forward in your business ownership journey?
I think the biggest one is probably how to manage a team and how to manage every individual within a team. Mm. I was a South African on the British playground as such, and I guess every culture or every country does things differently. And I did things quite differently and I did things the wrong way. So I learned the hard way. And I quite quickly had to adapt to not only a new culture, but teams that were with people from all over. And so you really have to understand what the individual wants out of the experience. And you have to recognize from a soft skill perspective, or, you know, that I might want something different to what someone else wants. And to get the best out of them, you've got to put yourself in their shoes. And you read about this stuff, but I think you can only learn it by actually doing it. And the process of, you know, at Deloitte, we spent a lot of time in, on audits, but you would be rotated across audits. So I would spend 4 to 6 weeks in a team and then move to another team. You know, the environment was consistently changing and you had to understand the dynamic and then understand how you could get the most out of the team that you were either in or managing. And I think that's probably where I gained the most benefit.
Tell me more about how you adapted. I mean, how that transitioned across different teams, and then obviously later on into the startup environment. How did you manage that flow, and how did you adapt to that change?
I actually think that one of the biggest things about the question is kind of getting excited about whatever I was doing. So, you know, whether I was in an audit, you know, in Reading or being sent out to New York, I needed to know I was excited about where I was going, who I was working with, and what I was doing. Even if, you know, some of the work wasn't very exciting. So I think you need to, at least for me, when you put yourself in an environment, you need to get excited about what you're doing within the environment, to get exceptionally curious. And I would try and work out the dynamic. Yeah, I was very quiet early on to try and figure out what was happening with the current team before I said anything, which then helped me to understand, you know, what the dynamic was and how I fitted into that dynamic.
Interesting. So you're quite analytical, just making certain that you understand the full scope of maybe the playing field before, you know, setting up a strategy and a plan to sort of go off and execute, right?
Well, exactly. I remember my dad sent me a message just before the first day at Deloitte, and he said, keep quiet and don't criticize anyone. And that's some pretty sound advice. And so I tried. I'm quite a loud person, and I wouldn't say I'm always critical, but I do tend to be critical from time to time. And I tried really hard to do both of those, keep quiet and not be critical or not criticize anyone. And it was advice I would happily pass on to others.
You know, you also mentioned a few minutes ago that during that time there, you looked at and were able to really understand the different parts of some processes that needed to potentially, well, that's helped you out as you've gone forward. You know, what do you think is the biggest technical skill, because process is, I guess, technical skill that you've taken away from that journey that's allowed you to sort of stand on your own 2 feet and hold your own in the likes of investor calls and what have you?
Probably preparation. A really simple one. Before we did anything at Deloitte, we had to prepare, whether it be prepare for an audit, prepare for a call. It was preparation. And so being adequately prepared for whatever I'm doing, whether you're, you know, stepping out and starting something or going into an investor call with someone you don't know, or having this podcast, if I'm not adequately prepared, I can't deliver on it. And so really being prepared for whatever is next and knowing a potential, there's a couple of different outcomes. And if I can somehow think what those outcomes are and prepare for them, I myself and, you know, put my best foot forward every time I do so.
Speaking of that, I mean, I know just before we logged onto this call, I know you had an important call to obviously be taken part of. And just going back into that, it would be good to maybe open up the can and understand why you decided, what was the motivation to set up SmartWage back in the day when you guys, you know, founded it?
I always wanted to start something. As I said, I tried many things and I left my corporate job in 2018 and then in sort of mid-2019, I had 4 ideas I was exploring, and I went about discussing and working through all 4 ideas. And one was a marathon photo app, and another was a hair loss business, and then a travel app, which one day I would love to still do. But then the earned wage access idea, which is not mine. It's, you know, I'd heard about WageStream, which was the earned wage access lead in the UK, and they just raised their seed funding round. And a friend of mine worked at the company that funded them. And when I told my friends and family, you know, about this, the concept of helping people get paid and not waiting till the end of the month to get paid of earned wage access, there was no one who turned around and said it wouldn't work. Not one person. And that was probably the aha moment for me when, you know, there's always your one skeptical friend. And I wouldn't say the mom test is a great test for whether your business idea is a good one, because mom's always going to support you. But in this case, there wasn't really anyone who turned around and said, hold on, you know, giving people access to their salaries and wages before the end of the month won't work. And that's when I realized maybe we're onto something. And so, and when we looked at South Africa, arguably a country which is you know, it's a highly indebted country, highly illiterate country, where people were being completely taken advantage of by machinistas and loan sharks and pay their loans. You realize it was, they needed it more, the country needed it more than anyone else, yet they didn't actually have it. And that's why we wanted to obviously launch in South Africa, apart from the fact that, of course, I'm South African.
Okay. I mean, you mentioned, okay, smart wage helps people get paid, but, you know, what's, who, is it everyone? Or is it, you know, obviously I'm also from South Africa. Is it very much targeted at, maybe it's sort of the gardeners, the kiosks, those type of folk? Who are you guys targeting?
So when we started, we naively thought the product was for everyone. And in fact, it is. And so when we thought about building a product, we tried to build a product in the beginning that was going to serve the entire market. And that was kind of our first big mistake. And so we quite quickly realized we needed to focus on a specific niche. And so we went and spoke to all the customers we could. And you know, a lot of them were not customers at the time, but we went and spoke to tons of people to figure out whether they would use earned wage access and whether it's something that they needed. And we realized that while, you know, the concept of earned wage access actually applies to anyone with a salary, we needed to focus on building a product that solved a specific problem for a specific market. And so we focused on really the lower LSM, people who earn less than 12,000 Rand, typically work in a metropolitan area, have some form of literacy and digital literacy, and who struggle to make it to the end of the month. And it turns out that sort of 80% of South African employees struggle to make it to the end of the month. And thus we realized, you know, the market was pretty big. And then we had to figure out how to get a product in their hands and do so in an accessible way. So, you know, I think one of the things we've done is talk to all of the, or not all of the founders, but a lot of the founders across Europe and across in America who've done businesses similar. And we try to work out what they've already figured out with building out their product so that we could apply the same learnings in a different way to South Africa. And so we deliver our product through WhatsApp and USSD, which is kind of, if you have a feature phone and a bank account, you can use us. There's no download of an app. And it takes 45 seconds to register and 45 seconds to take an advance. And it's an exceptionally simple product aimed at the lower LSM, who, in our opinion, are the people that need it the most.
Okay. So cool product, no doubt. How did you engage and speak with your target market? They're in 12,000 Rand a year. It's 12,000 Rand and 12,000 pounds.
12,000 Rand a month.
Okay, 12,000 Rand a month. Yeah. So it would be interesting. How did you go out and find these people and then obviously do your research and talk to them to make certain that not only there's a product market fit, that you provided them the right product or access to the right product that they can physically use? I mean, that would be interesting, right?
So we spent a lot of time, actually, we just went out to a lot of malls and to areas where there was a lot of people, and we started doing surveys. People were, you know, it was quite hard to talk to people initially because they didn't really want to talk to you about some random thing. And we realized there was a big gap between how we were explaining earned wage access. You know, explaining earned wage access is tough enough as it is. And so we went through quite a few iterations of figuring out how do we explain what we're doing. We were, at one stage, we were a payday solution, but then people were comparing us to a payday loan, and there was negative sort of connotation with the word payday. So we had to figure out a way to A, explain it to our consumer, and then B, figure out whether they actually wanted to use it. And then if they wanted to use it, what channel they'd prefer to use it on. You know, would they like an app? Would they, you know, like to use it through SMS? Do they want to be called? Do they want a WhatsApp? Do they want USSD? What are the ways that we can deliver this product and put it into their hands so that we can ensure that the product is sticky and that it's, you know, adds value to the consumer, and that makes sense for us as a business and for the employer and for the employee?
Yeah, this feels like a lot of hard yards, right? You're going out there physically, if I understand you correctly, physically going out to malls in the UK and Europe, shopping centers, and, you know, speaking to people. So, I mean, how long did that take? I mean, it seems like a lengthy process in this instance for, you know, African consumer.
Yeah. So we didn't do it in the UK and Europe. We had a team in South Africa going into South African malls, and it actually didn't take as long as you would have thought, because the answers became quite similar very quickly. And so we realized we were going to build an app, and then we moved to WhatsApp and USSD, and we realized those were the two channels that people wanted. And as soon as we were able to build we sort of got a WhatsApp, I say chatbot, it was literally a SIM card and a phone, to test whether people wanted to use WhatsApp. And we did the same with USSD. We managed to dial into a service provider that offered a USSD channel, and we used a very simple, you know, user journey, and it worked. People wanted it. And we realized, you know, they didn't just want it, you know, they wanted it a few times a month, and they wanted it every month. And I think that was kind of, you know, that took us a couple of months, but that was when we realized, I think, that we'd got product market fit, and we're still obviously quite happy with the decision we made to this point.
And you mentioned user journey there. Can you walk us through maybe a simple example of a user journey, so your tech in action?
Sure. So I think it's important to mention that we partner with employers first. So we're B2B2C business. So we partner with employers to then give their employees access to earned wages. For us to give someone access to what they've earned, we need to understand how much they earn and what their pay cycle is. So we integrate into an employer's payroll system, and then we register and activate employees. For an employee, it's as simple as dialing into a WhatsApp number or a USSD number and going through a journey. So, you know, hi, Richard, welcome to Smart Wage. Would you like to register, or would you like to learn more? I'd like to register. And there's, you know, a couple of steps to sign some TNCs or agree to some TNCs. And then you're registered. It's literally one step. And then to take an advance, you dial in and say, hi, can I please get access to my earnings? And it says, great, you've earned 840 Rand or whatever it is, you know, to date. Would you like to access this? And confirm yes. And it's paid into your bank account within 24 hours. It's really that simple. We've focused, it sounds like, oh, it's really easy to build, but it's taken us a long time to get to that point. And the back end is obviously a lot more complex to enable us to deliver it. But what the consumer sees is an exceptionally simple WhatsApp journey or USSD journey that allows them to register, educate themselves, access their earnings, and down the line, we're going to be providing a bunch of ancillary services, including debt consolidation products, savings products, investment products, or bank accounts, which I think is where it gets really, really exciting.
You've done the hard yards. You've looked at the markets. You've done your research. You've chatted to consumers. You've built the product that they want, which is, you know, awesome. You've also then clearly partnered up with some employees to get the app or, you know, the tech into the palms of their employees. I guess the question I have is, how did you guys then look at and decide what steps to take in order to go to the next level and start scaling your business?
I wouldn't say that we were at scale-up stage yet. We realized we spent a lot of time iterating on whether we'd built a product that people wanted, and we realized that quite early. But then the second part, which was really important for us, was, are we making an impact? Are we actually helping people by offering them the solution, or are we actually just making this whole payday cycle worse? And we actually realized and moved a parameter place to make sure that we are impacting people. And that took the majority of sort of the first year. When we realized we'd got the technology that we'd built that could scale, we you know, went out to raise further funding. We'd obviously had enough, you know, traction and users to be able to test and iterate with for us and our funders to be comfortable that we're onto something. And now, you know, we're obviously, we've raised some money, which hasn't been announced yet, but we've raised a bunch of money during our seed round. And now it's about putting in place those processes we spoke about in order to support growth.
I guess maybe that's what I was alluding to. So sorry if I didn't come across like that. So the approach, processes, what are you looking at right now? What are the operational structures and or processes that you have put in place over the last maybe 6 or so months, or looking to the future, are thinking of putting in place to sort of support that that growth?
So we predominantly use two techniques. The first one is OKRs. It's a goal management framework, which stands for objectives and key results. And I'm sure a number of your other guests would have spoken about this, but really an objective tells you where to go and key results tell you how to get there. And it's I think it was done by Google, but it can obviously mean different things to different people. But for us, it's a framework for growth. An objective for us is create scalable activation processes. So that's the objective on an activation front. And the key result will be to make sure that for every company we work with, 60% of their employees are activated and are done so, and 40% of those are done digitally. So we're creating scalable digital activation processes. And that's been a really powerful tool that we use every quarter to kind of align us to what is ultimately our sort of 1-year goal, a 5-year goal, and our 10-year goal. And that sort of gets us to the other thing we use, which is the OPSP, which is your one-page strategic plan. And, you know, one-page strategic plan is really making it easy for everyone in the company to know where they're going and what they need to do to get there. We kind of put together our mission, our vision, our OKRs, how we do things, who our customers, and we put it all into one page. So at any given time, we know what the North Star is and where we're going. And the last one, as I said, just mentioned, is the North Star. What is the one metric that everyone needs to follow to know that should that metric be increasing in line with what we wanted to increase, we're achieving our goals as a business. So those are the three processes we use, or frameworks we use rather, to support growth.
How does it unravel if you look under the tin? What are the key focuses that you need to, that you're thinking of right now to get in place for things such as, for example, systems? Are you looking at, I'm just going to throw a couple of names out there, but obviously it might not be your systems. Are you looking at things such as NetSuite from a financial perspective? Are you looking at, you know, Jira for, you know, incident management as an example? Are you going down to that level, or are you sort of building the ship right now and then looking at things around systems? And then also, obviously, you know, the processes that glue these systems together?
Yes, very much so. But I guess the systems we're using depend on the team, or what we call the machines. And we've got a couple of machines. We've got a sales machine, an activation machine, and a development or technology machine. And so the technology machine is using Jira and the Agile framework in order to build the product. We use, obviously, we've used two different CRMs for our sales team. We use Trello a lot, the sort of Kanban boards to manage processes. And one of the things we're introducing at the moment is really trying to build out cross-functional rhythm and cadence within our business to make sure that, you know, the sales team isn't siloed and away from the product team, so that the feedback that the sales team are getting from people they're talking to is fed into the product, and the product team are building really what the customer, being the employer and the employee, the feedback that both of those teams are getting are being fed into what ultimately becomes the product that the consumer sees and works with and deals with on a day-to-day basis. So I don't know if that answers the question.
Yeah, that's interesting. And tell me about the interaction between, I think it's quite a good example actually, the interaction between sort of sales and product. How does that all actually play out? Are you getting the benefits, i.e. is it playing out such that silos aren't developing and you are making certain that at the end of the day, the product is what the customer wants, and also sales are selling the right product?
I don't think we'll ever get to a place where we will have, you know, fully satisfied our customers' needs, but it's definitely helping. We've only recently implemented it. But a good example quite early on was when we were making or trying to make sales, we realized that, you know, everyone was really keen on earned wage access, but wasn't so keen on doing it without some sort of framework in place in order to help people manage their finances responsibly. And so we put together a basic education product that was direct feedback from sales. And then we realized, well, you know, it wasn't so much as only building out a big education product, but the nuances were that people wanted to, or employers wanted to, benchmark their employees. They wanted to understand how financially literate they actually were, what was their financial position. And so the feedback we're getting off the back of sales meetings that both didn't go well and did go well, it aggregates into something. And then we have feedback sessions to say, what feedback did we get this week and how can we use that to iterate on our product? And the same applies for customers. We realized that customers were dialing into our USSD a lot, but weren't taking in advance. So we spoke to those customers and, why are you not taking in advance? No, I just wanted to, you know, I wanted to check my balance. Oh, right. So then it was a case of the customer success team who'd now figured this out, feeding that back to the product team to make sure that we then put in a balance function. So there was a lot of these cases, and we hadn't really put in place the cross-functional teams together. And it became quite clear when we sort of broke each team up into a machine and then saw who was working on two different machines and how we could collaborate. And we're now in the process of making sure that we have company-wide meetings on certain things. The other thing that we do a lot of, which we absolutely love, is workshops. Workshops where you're bringing people from different parts of the business to solve a particular problem. So, you know, we're going live with a big partner next week. And so we brought not only the sales and partnerships team to the discussion, but the development team and the customer success team, because they actually see things from a different perspective. And so the way that they see the situation and understand the situation is different. And they often bring ideas that we hadn't thought of prior. And the workshopping is kind of a 1+1=3 example, where two people are better than one, and you're bringing different minds around the table to solve a specific problem. And often that solving that problem becomes much easier and good fun in a workshop.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting point you mentioned at the back end of that, and bringing your team, both business, i.e. sales, and also sort of tech guys in to solve room problems. And I guess that also creates alignment, and also, again, helps with that cross-functional understanding of what's actually happening out in the market, right?
Exactly. As I said earlier, one of the things we're trying to do is talk to as many people as possible. You know, there's a lot of people going down similar journeys, doing different things, but ultimately we are all trying to solve problems. And one of the guys we've got involved in the business is a guy called Adam Duxbury, and he's just an absolute genius when it comes to how to put people into their genius zones and help them solve problems. But he's chief of staff at a company called Yoko. And Yoko are, maybe I'm giving too much information here, but you know, Yoko are one of South Africa's sort of tech giants, or soon to be tech giants. And they're doing all the processes they've got, and how they solve problems has been worked out from some of the best companies in the world. And ultimately, we're trying to find out how do they solve problems, and how can we mirror that, or how can we figure out what they've figured out and do the same. So I'm a big fan of podcasts, and I listen to a lot of them to try and figure out the best of what other people have already worked out, and then applying that to what we do in some way.
Yeah, and that makes complete sense. Right? I think you hit the nail on the head. I mean, as an entrepreneur, you'll know that continuous learning is a must, right? So on that point, I mean, I know that you listen to podcasts, obviously, and I'm sure my listeners would love to know, what books have you read in the past or are reading right now that you think would maybe be a good thing for them to pick up and read as well?
The book I'm reading right now is The Prosperity Paradox by Clayton Christensen. It's really how innovation can lift nations out of poverty. And I'm finding it really interesting because it specifically applies to how you utilize capital and innovation in developing markets. And I think it's very, very different to how you do so in developed markets. I'm a big fan of all of these self-help books. And two rules I use, which are from a book called For Our Work Week by Tim Ferriss, which is the Parkinson's Law, and Pareto, which is the 80-20 principle. But Parkinson's Law is divergence here, but Parkinson's Law, which we apply across the company, is that work expands into the time given to it. But other books that I would recommend, everyone talks about Lean Startup. I think that's a fantastic book. The One Thing is great. And then for any company doing B2B sales or B2B enterprise sales, Crossing the Chasm has been a real eye-opener for me. Understanding how you take a product to market in an environment where you have early adopters and innovators who are really excited to use your product, but how do you then get your early majority, your bigger companies who require another big company to have used your product? And so you're faced with the chicken and egg. So Crossing the Chasm is one I would highly recommend. And then Innovator's Dilemma is the other one that I really like. Yeah, it's probably quite a long list.
Oh, that's a good list. Very good list. And listen, I mean, before we sort of wrap up today, I mean, I know you guys are obviously moving through the gears as you sort of move out that startup phase and you start really revving the engine. But what questions are you sort of asking yourself, and what factors are you considering to make certain that you hit that sort of that growth trajectory that you want to hit?
I think the biggest one is probably, how do we best serve our customers? Yeah, you know, everyone talks about Amazon being the most customer-centric company in the world, but it really is true. We need to make sure that we treat every single one of our customers as individuals. And then the second one is, how do I build a business that lasts a long time? And how do I think about and put processes in place now that enable that to happen? How do I see into the future? And I think that requires a lot of thinking, a lot of reading, a lot of listening. So those are probably the two biggest ones. And then maybe one other is, how do I ensure that the values and principles we started the business with to make a social impact, how do I ensure that we build a commercial model while still doing that? And I think that becomes increasingly difficult, but increasingly important, especially given what we do and how we do it. So I think those things are kind of the things that are keeping me up at night.
No, awesome, man. Listen, Simon, it's been an eye-opener today to run through your sort of journey. I've loved it. And definitely there's some really cool takeaways from this. So thanks a lot for logging in and taking your time out of a busy schedule right now.
Thank you, Rich. And thanks for all the great questions. It was great to chat to you. And I think there's so much people can learn from your show. Certainly learned a lot from some of the other guests. So keep doing what you're doing. Thank you very much.
Cool, mate. And before we log off, if people, listeners, want to get in touch with you or your team, what's the best way for them to do that?
So the website's www.smartwage.co.za. And if anyone wants to email me, my email is simon@smartwage.co.za. Not sure if I should say that, but I don't expect a flurry of emails. So if anyone does want to get in touch, we would obviously welcome a chat.
Okay. Listen, it's been amazing having you on the show and really looking forward to watching you guys this year and making certain that you guys have the most successful year, not only this year, but obviously in the years to come. It's going to be an amazing ride, right?
Cheers. Thank you, Rich. Appreciate it.